From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. The head of the American Medical Association talks about the Affordable Care Act and the association's priorities in the coming year. Then a team of physicists from UWM receive a National Science Foundation grant to study viruses and proteins at the molecular level.
One of the key goals is to determine the structure of a single molecule and make a movie of that, and that's in the future. We don't know whether we'll succeed, but we're arrogant enough to think we can do it.
We'll learn about the risks the extreme cold poses to structures like buildings and ships. And a new book explores the enduring legacy of the musical Fiddler on the Roof.
It's a story very much about change, about how a family is trying to deal with all of these kinds of forces of history that are creating changes to the community, to the family structure, to the ethos.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. President Obama will deliver his annual State of the Union address this evening. The first year of the president's second term was often a challenging one for Mr. Obama. Bitterly partisan fights over spending and the debt ceiling contributed to the ongoing perception of Washington beset by gridlock. The president also faces ever-growing concern over privacy issues, which he sought to address recently with an initiative to change the way the National Security Agency monitors personal communications. And then there's the matter of health care reform. More provisions of the president's Affordable Care Act have gone into place, like the creation of health exchanges that are designed to allow uninsured Americans to have greater access to affordable care. But that road has not yet been a smooth one, and questions linger for many affected by the changes. The president of the largest association of doctors in the country took on the issue of health care reform when she was in Milwaukee recently. The American Medical Association is a backer of the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Artis Hoven met with members of the Medical Society of Milwaukee County, and she also spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about the areas the AMA hears about most often.
People are very concerned about their health care. What's going to happen in this country? Health system reform. What does it mean for me? What does it mean for my family? Will I be able to keep my doctor? Will I have to change where I get my health care? So many of the issues around the continuity of care, how I'm going to receive it, who's going to be providing it for me, and can I get care? So I think the American Medical Association, as it's moved forward in its work around the Affordable Care Act, around many of the regulatory issues in the ACA, have dealt with many of those issues and trying to make sure that as we reach out and cover more uninsured patients, that in fact the way they get their health care is being delivered appropriately, that it meets the needs of the patients and the communities in which they live. And then also as we move forward, we talk about three major areas of work that the AMA is involved in: improving health outcomes, physician satisfaction and practice stability, and medical education.
Well, let's talk about each of those areas. I think the issue with outcomes maybe has been a little overlooked. I mean, there's this very loud debate in this country over healthcare reform, even as components have been going into place. But as that national debate goes on, there are still some significant public health issues that persist, especially in a place like Milwaukee. We hear in this community about things like infant mortality and a rise in the HIV rate. Regardless of who's paying for healthcare, has there been some loss of focus on health outcomes in this country?
I think we've always talked about health outcomes, but we've never really moved the dial in a meaningful way. And at the American Medical Association, that's what we want to start doing. And what we have decided to do is take on two long-term healthcare issues. One is hypertension, high blood pressure. The other is diabetes. And if you look at the morbidity and the mortality in this country associated with that, the sickness, the loss of life, the poor quality of life around those two illnesses, we have something we need to make changes on, and we are going to move in that direction.
I kind of envision a Venn diagram of all the various health outcome issues, and I would imagine that the overlap is pretty strong when it comes to both diabetes and hypertension.
When we talk about population health in this country, it's a language and a conversation which we need to be having more of. And so this is our opportunity to move forward. People say, well, why should the American Medical Association be concerned about health outcomes? We have in this country a great public health system. We've got all sorts of entities which deal with it. But why the AMA? Well, doctors see these patients every day. All of us, no matter what the specialty is, will see patients with high blood pressure and diabetes walking through their clinics and their operating rooms. We need to be a part of the equation.
Well, and so what part of the equation do you see the AMA filling?
Well, first off, let me talk about diabetes. We have partnered now with the YMCAs throughout the country through their work on the diabetes prevention program, looking at evidence-based studies that show that if you get individuals with prediabetes referred to YMCAs, where they take on a very strict protocol of exercise and diet with feedback loops to the healthcare provider, that you can cut the risks of diabetes significantly. So partnering in collaboratives is what we are going to do. We cannot do that alone. It's going to take communities. It's going to take doctors in communities and all healthcare providers in communities to, in fact, make this happen appropriately.
And then as far as hypertension goes?
For hypertension, we're partnering with folks at the NIH, some very brilliant people working around control of hypertension. Now, let me give you some statistics. About 30 million people in this country who have healthcare access have poorly controlled hypertension. So why is that? We know how to make the diagnosis. We know how to treat it. What is wrong? Why are these folks not getting their blood pressure controlled? Because poorly controlled blood pressure is associated with lots of complications. So we're going to figure this out, and we're going to be working with these people, putting on pilot studies, trying to figure out what works in communities, what doesn't. And I think it's going to be more than just the doctors in the doctor's offices. We're going to find that it's going to take the community working together to alleviate this problem.
You talked about NIH, and that's when talk about medical research comes in. Do we fund medical research at a high enough level in this country?
Probably not. We've worried about that for some years with changes in financing, the whole issue of costs. We need to look at that critically in the future and continue to do so.
Let's talk about some of the other areas the AMA is especially interested in. Is there an issue with professional satisfaction among doctors at this point in time?
As I've gone around the country and as many of us have learned over the last years and as we have listened to our colleagues out there, this feeling of not being empowered to do what you want to do as a physician, this dissatisfaction with what's happening in the care community, destabilization of practices around financing, for example, Medicare funding, and all the unknowns out there, what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act and so forth and so on. And so when you find out that doctors won't recommend to their children that they become physicians, there's a problem, and we've identified that. We started about a little over a year and a half. We did a study with the RAND Corporation looking at physician satisfaction and practice stability in 6 states, 30 practices, large ones, little ones, multi-specialty, single specialty. We learned some very important things. Not too surprising, but when you saw it in print and you understood what it meant, it was very sobering. Number one, the most important thing that makes physicians dissatisfied is when anything gets in the way of them being able to provide the highest quality health care that they can. And there are a lot of things that get in the way, regulatory, administrative, you name it. The other one that bothers them and dissatisfies them is the whole issue around the electronic health record. We had heard and we'd all experienced troubles, but we did not understand the impact of how the electronic health record was impacting physician practices, how much time they had to spend away from the patient, systems that didn't work, they were not interoperative, they didn't talk to each other, it didn't solve the problem, and in fact may not have improved the care that they were delivering. However, we like technology, so we have to fix this one. So what this has done is empowered us now to go forward with the regulatory people, with the federal government, with the administration of this country, and with vendors to talk about we've got to fix this problem, because simply sticking a doctor in front of a computer and making them check all the boxes isn't going to improve the quality of healthcare.
In a way, have we as a society kind of inserted a wedge between the doctors and the patient community?
Very much so. When I have to sit there and the interface is the computer screen, not the space between me and my patient, that's a problem. And for many of us, what we do is we do the care, scribble a few notes, at the end of the day, go back in, and 2, 3, 4 hours later have inputted all the data into the computer. That's not the way to practice medicine.
Another one of the key priorities the AMA has identified is changing the way medical education takes place. What is wrong with the system that has produced doctors in this country for decades?
Well, we've been teaching and training under the Flexnerian way, which was good 100 years ago, which is the way I was trained in medical school. But what we've realized is that we're putting physicians out there now, some of whom may not be as competent as we would like, number one. Number two, they do not understand the various issues around the delivery of care. By that, I mean the business aspects of it. How do you do this? How do you accomplish that? And then, you know, we teach them hospital-based care, which is where we got most of our training, and most of us get our care as an outpatient now. So those are just a few examples. What we're looking at now, and there's been much discussion for years, but the AMA sort of put its money where its mouth is. We have to change it. Let's help fund some institutions to look at innovative changes in how we educate our young men and women who are going to be our physicians as we age, and looking at some very innovative and very collaborative pieces of work. There are 11 medical schools now involved. This is exciting work.
I suspect, though, no one goes to medical school because they're interested in billing and the economics of medicine. Is that ever going to change, and should we expect it to change?
You're right on that. You know, we take men and women into medical school. They have passion. They're driven to do something that makes a difference, because being a physician is probably one of the most wonderful jobs in the world. And at the end, we turn them out and we've trained them. They know the science. They know what to do, what not to do, and that. But we need to make them able to move from the medical environment and their residency training programs into the real world space and continue that passion. So what we want them to be competent, we want to use their time wisely. Perhaps instead of calendar training, we do it competency training. They move through the system quicker. If they know they want to be a pediatrician, for example, they don't spend months and months in some educational piece of medical school that's probably not going to help them a whole lot at the end of their training. We want to make it better for them. They're more competent, they're happier in their shoes when they leave, and they're going to do a better job.
Much of the healthcare reform debate in this country right now is playing out through anecdotes. Who's been dropped from coverage? How much people are paying? This person is covered when they weren't before because of an underlying condition. How would you assess the state of healthcare reform in this country?
We started with an act, a piece of legislation in 2010, which we all knew was not perfect, but it was the best place to begin the process. When you look at what it addressed with the uninsured, the cost of care, the issue of fragmentation of care, many issues in those particular areas, we knew we had to make a difference. Something had to take place. It's not a perfect piece of legislation, but in fact, as we've begun to move this out, as for example with the exchanges, nobody in their right mind should have believed these would have run perfectly from the get-go. What we need to do is continue to sort of turn the knobs, make the improvements, make the adjustments, recognize where the challenges are, where the problems are, and agree to then solve them in a way to make it better for the patients utilizing the services and getting the care. I am always optimistic about this because I think what we had prior to 2010 in the Affordable Care Act was unacceptable. And in fact, we're moving in a better direction now.
We've been talking about healthcare reform, and there is this sort of ongoing gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands. And it's a debate. Do you see the medical community speaking with one voice in the healthcare reform debate? And does it need to?
It definitely needs to. We need to recognize, though, that there is diversity amongst us, and diversity is good because what it does, it challenges us to come to consensus, and that is the way everything needs to be done in our grand country. The Milwaukee County Medical Society is good evidence of that, what they've been able to do with improving access to health care, their immunization initiative, their patient safety efforts, coming together with one voice, doing things for their community that is very important. Good leadership starts at our community levels because that's where leadership is the toughest. And being able to get people together agreeing that this is the best pathway. You don't go from 0% to 100% buy-in, and you have to work at it. And that's where good leadership comes into play. But the Milwaukee County Medical Society has, in fact, done that in a very remarkable way.
Well, Dr. Artis Hovind, thank you so much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Artis Hovind is the president of the American Medical Association, which has around 217,000 members around the country. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke while she was in Wisconsin to speak with members of the Medical Society of Milwaukee County. Dr. Hovind referenced funding levels for medical research in this country. Well, coming up next, several UWM scientists have received federal funding for their part in a far-ranging project. The surprising connection between physics and medicine on Lake Effect. That's coming up next on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. X-rays, or electromagnetic radiation, were first observed and documented in 1895 when a German scientist was experimenting with a cathode ray tube. Within a month of his announcement, doctors and dentists were using the technology to see patients' teeth and bones. The technology and its safety steadily improved since then, and X-rays have been a standard part of the Western medical toolbox for quite some time. Now they can be used to see on a much smaller scale as well, the molecular level. A multimillion-dollar National Science Foundation grant will enable scientists at UW-Milwaukee to use a revolutionary X-ray machine to see how certain molecules, like proteins and viruses, behave in the human body. What makes this project even more interesting, however, is that physicists make up the UWM team, not medical specialists. Three of the team joined me in the studio recently, Drs. Abbas Urmazd, Dylan O'Saldan, and Marius Schmidt. Urmazd began by explaining what they're looking for and how this technology will help them find it.
Imagine you're trying to fix a car engine. It would be much easier if you had an X-ray shot so you know which parts to replace. Now, as far as proteins and viruses are concerned, they really determine how our bodies function. And if something goes wrong, we need to be able to fix it. And so having an X-ray, which tells you what the structure is you're trying to fix, is very helpful. So ultimately, not initially, but ultimately, what we're talking about is what's called rational drug design. That's to say, if a protein is like a lock, developing the right key to fit in it so you can turn it and a specific function is corrected. So ultimately, we're trying to find the structure of proteins and viruses in order to be able to understand the fundamentals of life, but also how to fix things which go wrong.
Now, what is interesting to me is that all three of you are physicists. You're not biologists. You're not medical people. But yet you're working on this from a physical aspect. And so how does physics play into this?
Well, the interpretation of the scattered X-rays is physics. So what we are trying to do is to recover the structure of the particle from their scattered distribution. That's where the physics comes in. I should say one thing. These protein molecules are extremely small. This is the reason we need an X-ray free electron laser, an extremely brighter by several orders of magnitude than any X-ray source that has existed before.
Does this laser exist?
Yes, the laser exists. And there are two lasers of this kind in operation and many more coming online. My colleague, Marius, has just been allocated beam time on this machine. It's a billion-dollar machine, and the time on it is 10 times oversubscribed.
It's kind of like I think of it as telescopes. People have to, book time ahead.
Yes.
This machine is 3 kilometers long, right? And so you have to fight to get on it because a lot of people want to use it. But you ask a really good question, Ronnie. What does physics got to do with biology? And the thing to realize here is that physicists think that there are only two games in town, physics and tiddlywinks. So physicists can do everything. And one example we'd like to give is Lawrence Bragg, who won the Nobel Prize, actually while he was fighting the First World War. And when he was in the trenches, he figured out how to sound range, identify the enemy's guns by looking at the echo of the bullets and shoot back at them. And so you can see a physicist goes and he was working on the structure of things, as we are, and at the same time, he was doing sound ranging. Now, physicists, of course, morphed also into Wall Street, as you know. And some people blame us for the meltdown, but we don't accept that.
No, why not?
Because we like to blame it on somebody else. The truth is you have to know the limitations of physics. And maybe some of us forgot in the financial industry that physics goes only so far. But I wouldn't admit that to anyone.
Of course not. And no one will hear this.
That's right. That's what I'm banking on, Bonnie. You're going to keep our secrets.
Also, physicists go into biology because they have nothing better to do no more.
Because it's all been figured out. Exactly. Well. So the research that you're going to be doing with this grant is hoping to discover how proteins affect health?
It really goes in stages. The first thing you want to know is if you're trying to pick a lock, you want to find the structure of the lock. So that's the first thing, to understand the structure of proteins, specifically proteins which are targets for drugs. It turns out, actually, the structure of these proteins happen to be very difficult to determine. So one of our first goals is to determine the structure of these specific proteins which are important therapeutically. That doesn't mean we're developing drugs. It means we're actually providing the structure of the lock which other people might want to pick.
Yeah, the important thing here is probably that Once we have that structure, we can also follow its function in real time because these machines allow us that, right?
Right. So exactly, as Mario said. And so once you know the structure, then you actually structure determines function. That's sort of an article of faith in the business. And so you actually want to see how these molecules function. So, for example, a molecule actually has to move like your fingers in order to perform its function. So all of us, in collaboration and in conjunction, want to make movies of single proteins going about their business. And so there's a lovely machine, for example, called the ribosome, which literally reads the genetic code on a tape and taps out a protein. We like to see that happen because many illnesses are to do with things going wrong with the way proteins are expressed. And we'd like to make movies, so-called molecular movies, of these kinds of molecular machines in action. And so the process to begin with is to determine the structure of proteins which are therapeutically important, whose structure is very difficult to determine with current technology, and then move on to looking at making movies of these proteins and viruses in action.
I assume that there's an awful lot of computational need that goes with that, that you're going to be crunching a lot of data.
That's right. And my colleague Delano and I are the biggest number crunchers here.
The fact is this machine produces huge amounts of data. Each exposure contains about a million bytes of data. And if you run it over several hours or several days, you can easily run into millions of megabytes, i.e. terabytes of data. So one needs a very, very powerful computer to be able to analyze all this data. The thing is, the information is kind of often hidden under the noise in this data, and we want to extract that.
Now, do you have a way of doing that at this point, or
yes.
Do you not know? Okay, you do.
Yes. We,
okay.
we both have different methods for extracting the information, and it seems to work in simulations, so we just need to now work on actual data.
In one experimental run on this machine, you create more information than the Encyclopedia Britannica, all the volumes. And you have this huge amount of data, and you're looking for very specific kinds of information in that. And so we have to have algorithms, which are very powerful search algorithms, a bit like Google, except far more powerful and far more sensitive to the signal and far better at discriminating against noise. And then you look for very specific kinds of information. So you have to have very sophisticated search algorithms, and we run these on special kinds of machines. And the biggest problem with these machines is you need to cool them. And so we never have enough air conditioning. It's not that they're large, they're actually tiny, but they do calculations so fast, they generate a lot of heat, so you need to get rid of that. And so Delano and I have both been working, and also with Marius, on ways of searching for specific kinds of information. And some of this stuff has been done by simulating what would happen in real signal, but actually we're also working on real data. One of the key goals is to determine the structure of a single molecule and make a movie of that, and that's in the future. We don't know whether we'll succeed, but we're arrogant enough to think we can do it.
And are we looking at a couple of years for that, or is it too much to try to even guess on that?
I think the view that the National Science Foundation takes of this, and this is the reason for this large grant, is that it takes roughly a decade to take a technology like this from where it is now to where it can really be used as a tool. And so the grant initially is for a 5-year period, but the assumption is that if our work goes well, that it'll be renewed for another 5 years. We're not going to wait to the last day of the decade and say, now take the lid off the box to see what's inside. And so clearly, there will be a lot of interim results. And so one of the interim results, I hope, will be from the BEAM time, which Marius has won and is coming up in June.
Yeah.
And how long will you have?
It's interesting. They have 4 days only. But you can imagine in these 4 days, you can collect data that you can analyze them for the next 2 or 3 years, basically. And this is not a small collaboration. This is a collaboration of 20 to 30 people, and all have their specific tasks. At the end of the day, we hope that we get a positive result here, right? And then can verify that that experiment will work at the XFEL, right? Or at a free electron laser, and repeat this experiment to go to times where nobody went so far, with in structure determination, which means these ultra-short femtosecond timescales. This is, one cannot even make a comparison. This how far goes a light in a femtosecond? It's maybe a micrometer, not even a micrometer. This the light does not even travel a fraction of a hair in this femtosecond timescale. This is amazing how short these timescales are. But as you know, that chemical reactions, also reactions in biological molecules, which are nothing but chemical reactions, can be quite fast. They are very fast processes, and these fast processes are at the center of the interest that the people have in the moment because they were not able to access these timescales so far.
Before now.
Yeah, before
right.
now.
Right. right. So this technology is allowing us not only to see farther in, it's allowing us to see in much quicker bits.
Absolutely.
Exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
but,
and the scale is it really has to be emphasized. Maria said light travels only a fraction of the width of a hair. And yet light travels 186,000 miles per second. So this gives you some indication of just how short a time.
This is obviously a hugely important grant and a hugely important honor for the university to receive. You know, you guys must have been very happy when that came through.
Well, I have to say happy and lucky because when at this level where of 600 applications, only 3 year are granted, you have to be fortunate. And I think I have to say we're fortunate. But somebody said that the harder I work, the luckier I get. And here, actually, the people who've been working hard, I have to say, are they really the chancellor, the provost, and the deans, who for some years have invested in this effort and really supported it. And I think it goes to show UWM several things. First of all, UWM has real excellence in its faculty, and it needs to be nurtured. And it needs to be nurtured with a long-term view in mind. And there's no reason why UWM can't really play at world class. So I've worked, you know, at Oxford. I'd work at Bell Labs or 11 Nobel Prizes. I've run a national lab in Germany, and I've been on staff of universities in Berlin. And when I came to UWM, I was really struck by the outstanding quality of the faculty. And in a way, it's very, very, very Midwestern to underestimate that. And so you find people are very modest. And the modesty sometimes goes also into estimation of what they can do.
Well, it's just such an honor to have all three of you here, and congratulations on the grant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Abbas Ormazd is Distinguished Professor of Physics and Electrical Engineering at UWM. Dylan O'Sullivan is Professor of Physics, and Marius Schmidt is Associate Professor of Physics. They, along with senior scientists Peter Schwander and Russell Fung, make up the UWM team that received a large National Science Foundation grant to create an NSF Science and Technology Center to study the structure of proteins and viruses using powerful X-ray lasers. Well, the cold has returned. We'll learn how it affects man-made structures like ships and bridges when Lake Effect continues next on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North, and it's great to have your company. The extreme cold we're once again experiencing has very real and very significant impacts on human beings. But the cold also has an impact on man-made structures, too. Buildings, bridges, and ships on Lake Michigan all face perils when it comes to temperatures as low as the ones we're experiencing. Charles Ryerson has studied how cold and ice affect superstructures. He's with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire, and he joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich from his office there to explain why cold and ice are subjects of scientific interest.
The majority of us on the planet in the mid-latitudes and farther poleward experience winter. And winter we all live with and tolerate, but it has its costs and its hazards. In its use of energy, in its effect on human health, and on effect on the economics of how we do things. And so it has a very high cost, and as I say, we tolerate it because it's something we have to live with. And surprisingly, there's not more done with it than is research-wise than there is, frankly.
Well, and so we hear a lot about engineering in, say, hurricane or earthquake-prone areas. But let's talk about the particular engineering challenges in a place like Milwaukee or another northern kind of city in which there's a frequent freeze-thaw cycle, and it can get down to 10 below or 20 below or even colder than that. What are the engineering challenges to structures like buildings or bridges or other large man-made objects?
Well, initially, of course, the foundations have to be built to withstand soil freeze-thaw and heaving of the soil and migration of moisture, which forms frost lenses, which those of you in the northern latitudes, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, we had this problem. Potholes forming in roads where water migrates up because of the freezing and forms a lens, and then, of course, it expands and breaks the pavement away. So the first thing you have to deal with is a foundation. And then, of course, once the structure is built, hopefully on an appropriate foundation, then you have problems of icing and snow formation on power lines, for example, on tall towers, tall buildings. For example, the new 1776 tower that was built in New York had quite a bit of there was quite a bit of concern about ice formation on that structure and of falling to the pavement and being a hazard to people. So structures accumulate ice, for example, from either freezing rain or snow, from rime ice, or sometimes even from snow that you'll get freeze-thaw cycles, as you mentioned earlier, and water will run down into a crotch, let's say, where two structural members come together. It'll form a chunk of ice that may be the size of a baseball. And if that falls then 500 feet to the ground and it weighs a pound or two, it can be lethal, actually.
Is there anything that you can do to engineer a building or a bridge to keep that ice from forming or to mitigate how it falls?
Actually, design can be a fairly significant way to deal with ice, but it all depends on the kind of ice that's going to form. If you have ice that forms from freezing rain or snow, it's pretty difficult because freezing rain or snow will land on and stick to just about anything. If you have in-cloud icing, so let's say you have a fog that forms and you have tiny cloud droplets that are 20 microns in diameter, then airflow causes them to either strike an object and freeze and cause ice to grow into the wind, or the droplets will pass around it. And as this seems counterintuitive, but larger diameter objects ice less than smaller diameter objects because water droplets in clouds or fog will tend to flow around larger diameter objects, but they'll tend to collide with smaller diameter objects and freeze.
Huh. So we've heard about these ships in the Antarctic region trapped in the ice, which is obviously a consistent problem in that part of the world. But how do bodies of water like the Great Lakes ice up in comparison to sea ice? And what are the unique problems that icing on the Great Lakes might cause to ships and other structures on the lake?
Well, any, we'll call it a seagoing vehicle or a vehicle that's out in the ocean. So now we're talking about offshore platforms in the oil industry or ships will ice if spray is created either by waves or by, in the case of a ship, its bow plunging into the seas. So in the ocean, we have salt water, and the typical salinity of salt water is about 33 parts per thousand, fairly high. High enough that the freezing point is depressed by a couple of degrees Fahrenheit. And when the water lands on the vessel, in particular, the large amounts of water to land on a ship, the water will freeze. But water doesn't freeze with salt in it. So what happens is that the water freezes, it excludes the salt and causes it to be concentrated in what we call brine pockets. And those brine pockets weaken the ice.
But this is why people, you know, use salt to break up ice on the roads, for example.
That's right. But in the Great Lakes, we have fresh water. And freshwater ice freezes, of course, at 32 Fahrenheit. And it doesn't have salt in it. And as a result, it forms clear ice. And it's much harder and much more tenacious in the sense that its adhesion strength to substrates, to decks, to railings, to whatever on a ship is much, much stronger. So when the Coast Guard goes out with their small icebreakers and tries to either do search and rescue or create passages for ships, they experience superstructure icing. Now, they don't experience it when they're breaking ice. The floating ice suppresses the waves and you don't get any spray. But if they're in transit, let's say between Sheboygan, Cross Lake, Michigan, when they're in the open lake, the spray will form on the ship. The bow generates spray, then that passes up over the ship. And it can be sufficient to cause so much weight and such an increase in the height of the center of gravity of the ship that it'll founder, it'll roll over and sink. Fortunately, we haven't lost a Coast Guard cutter that way, I don't think, since the Second World War, and that was in the Atlantic. But fishing trawlers are lost every year. I don't know what the current statistics are, but those that watch reality television have seen crabbing boats certainly ice up, and the technology we use to de-ice them today is what we've used for the last several hundred years probably, and that's mallets and things like baseball bats.
Well, and so this brings us back to our initial question about the key reasons you study cold and ice. Is this an issue that people are taking on, better ways to de-ice a freshwater ship?
To de-ice any ship, freshwater or saltwater, is a significant problem. And right now it's being looked at pretty carefully because the Arctic Ocean is opening up. And as the Arctic Ocean opens up, there'll probably be more activity up there, commercial activity, tour boats, maybe military activity, we don't know. As a result, the Coast Guard is going to have a much more active presence, at least off the north coast of Alaska. And they'll be pushing the envelope in the sense of the edges of the season. In the late fall, early winter are the most dangerous times up there for superstructure icing, as we call it. And so the goal is to try to develop better ways to either prevent icing on ships and offshore platforms or to remove it without having to send people out on deck with baseball bats or whatever and to break it off, because now you have people out in the elements on a rolling ship on a icy deck swinging mallets, and it's a pretty serious thing to have to ask people to do in those conditions. The problem with icing is that most of the times it doesn't sink ships, but it is a safety hazard to the ship because the anchoring hardware is frozen in, navigation aids are frozen in, sometimes the radars become frozen, antennas ice over and they can't communicate effectively. And so most of the time it's a hazard. We'll call it a safety hazard rather than a threat to life, but it can easily become a threat to life.
Well, Charles Ryerson, thanks so much for helping shed some light on this issue for us.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Nice to talk to you.
Charles Ryerson is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory, or CREL, in Hanover, New Hampshire. We reached him there by phone. We'll take one last break and then the story of how the iconic musical Fiddler on the Roof came to be and what it meant to us then and now. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Night after night in the dark I'm alone, so find me a match. Of my own.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. If I Were a Rich Man, sunrise, sunset, tradition. From Broadway productions to high school performances, Fiddler on the Roof has captivated audiences around the world for 50 years. The story of a poor Jewish family in Russia at the turn of the last century would seem at first glance to have limited commercial appeal. And in fact, the show almost didn't get made because theater producers in the early 60s couldn't see how they'd sell enough tickets to Gentiles. But the show did get made, and the rest is, well, history. And a compelling history it is. In Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof, author Elisa Solomon takes us from the original Sholem Aleichem stories the musical was based on to the most recent revivals of the show on Broadway. Solomon was in Milwaukee not long ago to read from her book, and she joined us in the studio then. Elisa, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Fiddler on the Roof, such an amazing thing, almost 50 years old now, the musical, not the stories that it came from. What is it about this musical and about these stories of Tevye that managed to somehow capture the world? Because they are so specifically Jewish of a particular time that actually didn't even really exist in the stories.
It's such a good question, and it was really the animating question of my work on this book. There's a lot of answers. It spoke very specifically to the Jewish American experience in the mid-1960s. The show opened, as you say, nearly 50 years ago in September 1964. And this was a moment of great turmoil in the United States. The civil rights movement was very active and also starting to confront the limits of liberalism. The women's movement was gaining a lot of steam. Fiddler went into rehearsals just as the feminine mystique had come out. There was so much going on that the show reflects of that American moment and does so through this story specifically about Jews of Eastern Europe in the Pale of Settlement. And it's a story very much about change, about how a family is trying to deal with all of these kinds of forces of history that are creating changes to the community, to the family structure, to the ethos, to the possibility of maintaining some old ways. These are all the kinds of things that America was dealing with in that moment, and Jewish America too, both in that general sense and in also a very specific communal sense. The community was very concerned in the 60s about what they took to be the threat of interfaith marriage. You know, now that anti-Semitism was not such a threat in the United States as it had been in earlier decades, and Jews were having access to universities and jobs and social situations and housing, neighborhoods, you know, all kinds of things that had been closed to them before. Now that those threats were not so dangerous, they were starting to worry about the threats from within. Now that they had all this access, now that they could mingle, now that their kids could go to any university, now their kids were meeting all kinds of kids and marrying them. And so now the threat was coming from inside the community, which is reflected in those Tevye stories as well. So both in the general American way and in the very specific Jewish American way, the themes of the show spoke very directly. And then, of course, had wider universal appeal, as those concerns about generational conflict, the sustaining of tradition in the face of change, and so on, belong to really any culture whatsoever.
You made a really interesting comment at one point where you said that Fiddler gave post-McCarthy American Gentiles the Jews they could love and wanted to love, which I found really interesting because, of course, when you move it 30 or 40 years ahead, people were saying, well, it's either not Jewish enough or too Jewish. You know, it's like the show was straddling those concerns as well in the greater culture.
Mm-hmm. So you refer to the McCarthy period, and Fiddler comes out of a moment when the McCarthy period is really over. And there's, you know, I think a big sigh of relief generally in the United States, but especially in the Jewish community. There was a taint of Jewish community as being communist, inaccurately, but there was a lot of anxiety in the organized Jewish community during the Red Scare period. There were purges of leftists from Jewish organizations. The American Jewish Committee actually supported the execution of the Rosenbergs. There was just a lot of nervousness, and many, many Jewish artists, including Zero Mostel, who starred in Fiddler, were blacklisted. And other members of the company, namely Jerome Robbins, the director and choreographer, had named names before the House Un-American Activities Committee. One of several reasons, that there was a lot of tension between those two geniuses. So in the early 1960s, when the authors start working on the show, I think it's a moment when Jews are ready to come out of the closet. You know, there was a big push in the 50s for the Jewish community to be saying, we're just like everyone else. We are full-blooded Americans. So even the tercentenary celebration of Jews in America in the mid-50s was a celebration of American democracy, this almost year-long series of events that were organized all over the country, and hardly any mention of Jewish identity or Jewish practice or anything remotely like that. It was all about the assertion that we belong completely to the American culture. And I think part of that is a response to the accusation of communist taint. So by the 60s, that's finally over. And even though the creators of Fiddler didn't realize it at the time, and some producers that they took the script to, you know, exactly wondered if the show would be popular, you know, one of them famously said, well, this is all very nice, but who's going to buy tickets once we run out of Hadassah groups? They didn't recognize that Jewish audiences and other audiences were ready to recognize, yes, that Jews are solid members of the American polity in every way, full citizens in every respect. And that means that their heritage and their difference can now be recognized and celebrated.
And somehow that becomes universal, that immigrant experience is one that all people or most people here shared.
This was a moment, too, when the way America was thinking about itself and its history was changing. The immigration policy was changing in the 60s. The idea of America as a nation of immigrants became a primary way in which we talked about ourselves as a nation.
Really, that was first. That was the first time we were really thinking that way?
Other people had said such things before, but as a really defining idea, a common idea, a widely accepted idea, something that presidents were talking about. Social historian Matthew Fry Jacobson writes about these kinds of issues, and I like the way he describes this moment. He says the locus of the American origin story around this time shifted from Plymouth Rock to Ellis Island.
Let's talk about the show itself, because as you said, Jerome Robbins, who is a wonderful choreographer and American director, West Side Story, I'm thinking, all kinds of other things, Zero Mostel, very famous. And the story that you tell of getting the thing to stage is amazing. I mean, most shows have some kind of like, oh, my God, tearing your hair out in the back wings. But this was amazing that it ever got onto the stage at all.
In a way, I guess, but I think it was destined for glory from the beginning. But I had a lot of fun doing the research and trying to recreate what it was like in those rehearsal rooms. So, you know, starting with the various drafts of the scripts early on and Jerome Robbins sending his notes to the librettist Joseph Stein and to the composer and lyricist Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick and starting to hammer it into shape before they rehearsed it, and then the audition process, and then rehearsals in New York, and then taking it on the road in to Detroit, and then Washington, D.C., before it came to New York, and all along the way, changes being made. I mean, the show never changed its general shape or focus, but internally there were huge changes. There were, you know, songs that seemed to be great songs, and some of them actually are recorded and you can find them and listen to them. Others are in archives at the Library of Performing Arts in New York. Songs just like thrown out, you know, new songs written in hotel rooms while they were on the road, fights in rehearsal. The show-stopping number in the wedding scene, the bottle dance, wasn't put into the show till the very last minute. Jerry Robbins was kind of secretly working on it and put it into the show in Washington, I think just about 2 weeks before they were coming to open in New York. And thank God, because that's such a great, great dance.
What an amazing scene it is. And you think that, oh, the show almost didn't have that. Did people in the cast and crew and, you know, design team that you talked to, did they have any sense that this was going to be the cultural icon that it became?
None at all.
It was just another show.
It was just another show for a while. And in Detroit, you know, they were working so hard on the road, and Robbins was quite a taskmaster, and they would perform at night, rehearse all day, perform at night, rehearse all day, and they were all exhausted and ragged, and he never let good, you know, well enough alone. They were probably too exhausted to even see what beautiful shape it was coming into. But they started to feel it in Washington. You know, after they'd played some weeks in Detroit, moved on to Washington, there were lines around the block for tickets. That had to be because of word of mouth. You know, there hadn't been local press yet. And they started to get very strong ovations and receptions. And they started to have a sense that, okay, you know, we're going to be employed for a while. That's good. But that it would have that iconic status nobody could have imagined. That came as a shock even to the creators.
And then you fast forward 40 years to the revival in 2004, the one that Alfred Molina starred mm-hmm. in, and then Harvey Fierstein mm-hmm. took over Tevye for. And, you know, the show had taken on this amazing, I don't know, it's like we all own it.
We all own it and we fight over it.
You know, yeah, like families do.
Yes, exactly. You know, who else is allowed to do it? Is it authentic enough? Is a particular actor doing it the right way? All those kinds of questions come to the fore and reveal our own moment, I think. So when there was a controversy over the 2004 revival, there were some critics who were complaining that it wasn't, you know, so-called Jewish enough, which is, you know, kind of ironic. I mean, here the original producers or original potential producers were turning down the property, saying it's too Jewish. And now 40 years later, you know, some people are saying, well, it's not Jewish enough. So exactly, you know, what happened? How did this work turn into a kind of folklore in the meantime and become something that all of us own and all of us look to for different reasons? And in the case of some of those critics, they look to Fiddler for their own Jewish identity and they expect it to stay the same. It became the tradition that wasn't allowed to change.
Do you think it will continue to ask of us what tradition means and what roots mean and what our generational differences mean, no matter whether we're Jewish or not?
I think it will. I mean, I think that's at the heart of it. And it's actually at the heart of the original stories by Shlomo Aleichem that the show is based on. And that's part of why it has that power. It sustains that power. Those questions and concerns are embedded in the very source material and in the figure of Tevye, who is very much an on the one hand, on the other hand kind of guy, both how he reasons things through and how we experience him in this really dialectical place between holding on to something, letting go of something, between stasis and change, between the old and the new, and so on.
Alisa, it has been such a pleasure having you in the studio this morning. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Alisa Solomon is the author of Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof. Solomon was a theater critic for the Village Voice from 1983 to 2004, and she also contributed to the New York Times and The Nation, among other publications. She currently teaches at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, where she directs the Arts and Culture Concentration in the MA program. Solomon appeared at Boswell Book Company recently, and she spoke with us then. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.